Did that just happen?
Was that on the record?
that just happened.
You are now.
All right, we're back on the record. The next item on the agenda is proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 128. And these initiatives have become the tail docking of 2016.
Only slightly more successful. Madam Chair, Frank McNulty, proponent of Initiative 128.
And thank you. I'm Kathleen Curry, the other proponent on Initiative 128.
Do you want to start by telling us the single subject of your initiative?
The single subject is concerning congressional redistricting.
Okay. Is there anybody here signed up or wishes to speak on the single subject of this measure? And did you wish to speak on single subject? No? Okay.
Yes.
On single subject? Okay, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dan Bergman, speaking for myself. It seems to me that there are many different subjects being discussed, not just the redistricting, but mentions affiliations of political parties themselves, U.S. House of Representatives, establishing criteria to be used in setting boundaries for the congressional districts. Those are multiple subjects. So
okay. Any questions by the board? No. Any questions of the proponents on single subject? No?
No.
All right. Any discussion or you want to make a motion?
I believe that 128 constitutes a single subject, and I move that we proceed and set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Mr. McNulty, do you want to just tell us what you believe the difference is between this one and your last submission?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This initiative 128 deals exclusively with congressional redistricting and does not include legislative redistricting under this title.
Okay. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are comfortable with the with the title and question as drafted by staff.
Okay. Mr. Bergman, did you have any comments on the title?
No, none at this time. Thank you.
All right. Any discussion by the board?
There's a couple of little things that I'd like to raise. Although I know that the measure refers to the commission as an independent, in terms of the name of it being, you know, Independent Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission, I would propose that we strike the word independent out of the title.
I'm fine with that.
Why?
Whether or not it imparts one way or the other, that, you know, it's sort of a selling point versus it's not independent. It just, to me, it's creating a commission, whether it's an independent commission or whatever you want to call it. To me, it's that they're creating a commission for congressional redistricting.
Is the current, I guess there isn't one, but I mean, the current system is politically controlled, right? That's one of the significant differences here from the status quo. Independent suggests nonpartisan, which to me is relevant, and I don't see it as a catchphrase.
Well, whether it is or not, I think remains to be seen. I mean, there's obviously members of the commission that belong to political parties, some that are unaffiliated or minor political parties. I don't know. I mean, that may be the proponents.
Well, ask the proponents.
Well, I think that
how
maybe
is it independent?
Their objective is to have an independent commission. Whether it is or not remains to be seen. And just because they call it independent, I don't know that for the voters that necessarily means anything.
We did kick around the idea of really cool Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission, but we thought that you guys might think that to be a catchphrase, so we went with independent instead. Independent is an important piece of the independence of the commission. The independent commission is an important piece of what we're attempting to do here and is a central component.
And its independence is from?
Its independence is from the current political process that drives the drawing of congressional districts today by the General Assembly.
Which hasn't really happened for, I mean, really it's been drawn by the courts.
The courts, exactly. Last 4 out of 5 times.
Right.
That's why I think it is significant, is that it does convey that. And I don't think it's confusing, and I don't think it was a catchphrase, so.
I just don't think it really adds anything. I don't think it tells voters anything more than really cool Colorado Congressional.
You'd accept that change too, Madam Chair.
Would you really? I mean, I think that would kill your question.
So I'm going to go ahead and move that change on line 3 to strike independent.
I'll second it. And all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Yeah.
In terms of the reference to the U.S. House of Representatives that appears on line 6, it's really called Congress, and your measure refers to Congress.
Yes.
And so whether or not it should say Congress instead of House of Representatives, I know that the argument is that some people associate both the Senate and the House of Representatives as the federal in Congress, but...
I do think in the minds of most Coloradans, the two are interchangeable.
Okay, so I would go ahead and strike...
At least that's been my experience.
Strike House of Representatives and replace it with Congress. And I think it should be capitalized. Or, yeah. You guys... Okay, I would move that change on line 6.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. And then the next issue is something I think we've discussed on some of the previous redistricting measures that have come before the title as to whether or not the supermajority requirement is really a central feature in terms of the necessary vote to adopt anything or take any action by the commission. And I think in general, in the previous measures, we have not referenced the supermajority. And so I would move that we strike the language beginning on line 6, starting with specifying, all the way through on line 8, the semicolon after commissioners.
Have anything?
We do believe that the supermajority is central to the initiative that we are offering, and we would... oppose striking that language. We do oppose striking that language.
Did we put it back in at a rehearing or of one of them? Do you remember?
It's really hard to keep them all straight now.
I know. We need a chart.
I'm not making one.
So I have one of... I think the previous ones are 107, 122, and 123.
I have 122.
I have 122, 123, and 107.
Did we ever have it in, Grant? Do you remember?
Well, 120.
Didn't, okay.
122 didn't. It looks like we did on 123.
Added in there.
Yeah, it made reference to district maps had to be approved it said requiring the agreement of 6 of 9 commissioners to approve district maps.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking at 107. I don't think it did. So we've been inconsistent at best.
Right. Okay. Then I guess at this point I'm inclined to go with what the proponents want until an opponent comes in and tells me that it's...
Okay, so I would withdraw that change. And then I think the next change has to do with how we may have dealt with this issue on 107, in terms of, okay, so we're dealing with congressional redistricting. The existing criteria is for the court. And so I think we changed the title in 107 to say adopting existing criteria for congressional districts. Since there is some criteria, even though it's not criteria for the legislature, and whether or not we make that change here so that the language would read adopting existing rather than establishing criteria to be used. And then I think it's a question for the proponents in terms of, is the including competitiveness, is that an existing, or is your measure adding that as a criteria for congressional redistricting?
Criteria is not an existing, I'm sorry, competitiveness is not an existing criteria as far as the judicial direction in statute, so we are adding competitiveness.
So would it be more accurate to say adopting existing criteria to be used in setting boundaries of congressional districts and adding a new criteria of competitiveness or something along those lines to indicate that, because right now the way it's written indicates that competitiveness is part of the existing criteria?
Did we use competitiveness before?
That's consistent with what we did.
That's consistent with what we did in 107.
107. Okay, so. And adding competitiveness to the criteria, I think, is similar to what we did in 107.
I always trust you.
So, any discussion? Or do you want me to go ahead and move it?
Sure.
No, you can move it.
Okay, I would move the changes as they appear on lines 8 and 9.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And then I have a question for the proponents in terms of the phrase that's talking about judicial review. Is it judicial review an adopted map, or isn't there judicial review of both when there has been an adopted map and when the commission fails to adopt a map?
In this case, it is judicial review of an adopted map. The initiative is silent on the question of judicial review if the commission fails to act.
So that would be similar to the current situation when the legislature fails to act?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any other changes.
Okay. I'm going to read it in. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning congressional redistricting and in connection therewith, transferring authority to establish congressional districts from the General Assembly to a newly created 12-member Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission, requiring at least four commissioners to be either affiliated with a minor political party or unaffiliated with any political party, prohibiting commissioners from being registered lobbyists or members of or candidates for the U.S. Congress or the Colorado Legislature, specifying that all actions of the commission must be agreed to by at least eight of the 12 appointed commissioners, adopting existing criteria to be used in setting boundaries of congressional districts and adding competitiveness to the criteria, providing for judicial review of an adopted redistricting map, and requiring that the commission's work be done in public meetings.
Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me. Yes, Dan Bergman speaking for myself. I would like to propose that a couple of changes be made. In the first line, the words congressional and redistricting, the C be capitalized as well as the R. On line three, after the word Colorado congressional, C of congressional, R of redistricting be, well, and C commission be capitalized. So Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission be capitalized. And line seven, that all actions of the commission C be capitalized. And then in line nine, setting boundaries of congressional capital C, D, capital D for districts. And in line 10, capital R of redistricted map, and capital M map, redistricting map. And then further in line 10, requiring that the commissions work capital C of commissions, that C be capitalized.
Why?
We, well, let me ask the committee, why is it the word on line three, the word Colorado is capitalized?
Proper noun.
Yeah. Correct. These are proper nouns, right? Congressional, in the first line, congressional redistricting, the federal government. And then that in line three, that name, Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission, yeah, Secretary of State's offices is capital S, capital O, capital S.
I don't, the provision itself does not create that as the proper name of the commission. It's simply descriptive of the entity that it is creating. If you look at the actual provision, Colorado Congressional Redistricting Commission is not creating an official name of this entity. It's just creating a commission, and those are just descriptors. Unless I defer to you guys if I'm wrong about that.
No.
And all of the other things that you had identified in there, I don't think are proper nouns that should be capitalized. I'm fine with it the way it is.
In line 9, C for congressional and D for districts.
And not, they're not proper, those aren't proper nouns.
That does refer to U.S. congressional districts.
Well, if you were referencing congressional district 7,
in line.
Maybe, but we're talking about all of the congressional districts, and therefore it's not a proper noun.
Well, I was talking line, the first two words of line 9, congressional and districts.
Okay.
Right.
I think I'm fine
understand.
The way it is.
I think it's fine the way it is.
Okay. All right. Well, we still need a motion.
I would move that we adopt the title for proposed initiative 2015-2016, numbered 128, as it was read and appears on the screen.
A second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 132. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 130, proposed initiative 132 is a new and independent commission being formed to address the issue of congressional and legislative redistricting. And we do have one change that we'll suggest to the staff draft at your convenience.
Okay. Does anybody have any comments on whether this is a single subject? No. All right. Any questions? Okay.
I would move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-2016-132 constitutes a single subject and proceed to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to the title. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
We are comfortable with the staff draft with one exception. On line two, the staff has proposed renaming the Colorado Reapportionment Commission. The initiative, as drafted, strikes the existing commission and in its place creates a new commission to address congressional and legislative redistricting. We do propose striking renaming the Colorado Reapportionment Commission and in its place insert the word establishing.
If I could ask a question,
yes.
Speaker McNulty, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
In terms of 132 versus 107, I think 107 is yours.
Correct.
Sometimes it's hard to keep everything straight. But
we understand.
Understanding that 132 took a little bit different approach, a drafting approach, but in terms of the substance, other than, say, whether the current commission is repealed and a new commission is created, but in general, are there any major differences between 107 and 132?
The other substantive difference between 107 and 132 is the appointing of the unaffiliated and minor party members and the appointing authority of those members and the way in which they are appointed. Other than that, there are minor changes between the two, but nothing that I would say a substantive difference between the two.
That's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just trying to keep them all straight.
We do have a flow chart that I can get you later if you like.
No, no, please. While I agree with the proponent's comment about renaming the Reapportionment Commission to the new Redistricting Commission, I don't believe that's accurate. My thoughts took a little bit different approach. Rather than just not mentioning the Reapportionment Commission at all and saying you're creating a new one, whether or not something along replacing the Reapportionment Commission with, and whether you want to say the new or, you know, it is new, but I mean, the idea that you're getting rid of one because your measure does get rid of an existing entity, but recognizing that the approach in 132 did actually repeal the commission and then in a different place creates your new commission, whether or not something like that might be acceptable or?
It recognizes the construction of the initiative and we are not opposed to adopting that amendment in the place of the existing language.
Okay. is it with un-independent?
And independent?
Well, actually, you know, you want me to move to remove independent?
Probably.
That was going to be next.
you can, I guess. It seems that you have the...
Why don't we go ahead and include that one in with this? There we go.
Because then I can't support the amendment.
Log rolling for David.
We just lost that screen.
Did you have a comment, Mr.
Mayor? Yes. So we're replacing one entity with another. The entity doing the replacing is the Colorado Reapportionment Commission. I move that that reapportionment and the R of reapportionment, C of commission be capitalized because it is a proper name. I'm sorry, and further, capital I and independent, capital C and capital R for redistricting, and capital C and commission after, in line three, after the word Colorado. Again, because it is a proper name.
Well, I think we're getting rid of independent, and we've already had the discussion about the name, so.
And coming from a drafting perspective, I know that in drafting legislation, the rules of capitalization are somewhat different and funky. But in looking at the heading of Section 48, in which the Colorado Redistricting Commission is created, redistricting and commission, I don't believe are capitalized. I mean, that's part of the style, unusual style, maybe not grammatically correct.
Yeah, just to make clear, I don't think that it's actually creating a thing called the Colorado Reapportionment Commission. I think it is creating a thing that does reapportionment by committee. And therefore, I don't think the proposal does that, and I don't think we should change it. I'm not sure that it has a great deal of difference one way or the other, but I don't think it's accurate, and therefore I would not support it. And I won't object to your independence since I've already lost that one. So I'm not calling for a vote on that one again just to get whacked down one more time.
Based on that argument, should we be saying replacing, well, a Colorado Reapportionment Commission with a, I mean, if that's.
Well, I think there is a Colorado Reapportionment Commission, right?
So, okay. All right.
I think that's right.
Okay. So I would move the changes as they appear on lines 2 and 3.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Since the measure is taking the different approach of not the new commission sort of being a recreation, it's entirely new, I was wondering whether or not it should just say in that phrase that starts on line 3, directing that the commission redistrict congressional districts and state legislative districts, the language in the title for 107 used as well as, because it was adding to the responsibilities. And here, with a new commission, their responsibilities are just congressional redistricting and legislative redistricting.
Thank you.
So I would move those changes on lines 3 and 4.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Mr. McNulty, you said you didn't have any other issues with the language.
That is correct, Madam Chair. If the board wishes to adopt changes that have been made to help achieve consistency, then we'll make those changes, but we are comfortable with.
All right. And Mr. Bergman, did you have any other comments on the language?
Not on the language, but I do on something else.
What else?
Is this the proper time to bring...
I don't know what your issue is, so answer that question.
Just want to put the board on notice and like to schedule a rehearing.
Oh, you do that after.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You can file that with Mr. Ward. You can talk to him about that after.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, the next change I would propose is on line 4, to change the word 12 to the number 12, and that's consistent with what we done in general and what we did in 107. And I would move that change.
What do you want to make some other changes?
Oh, you want to just
rather than
them
move
all together,
them, sure. Right? Because I presume you're doing the same with 4, or you only whatever was consistent in the past. Because you're going to have to change 8 of 12 down later too, right? And if you don't, I'll be shocked if you don't address the competitiveness language.
Oh, yes, I've got that on it. It's coming.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think we have to do it one by one.
Okay. Well, then again, on line four there at the end, the word four should be replaced with the number four. Line seven to replace eight with the number eight, and to replace 12 with the number 12. I think that takes care of the numbers. Then on line eight, to strike establishing and replace it with adopting existing. And then on line nine, after districts, strike the comma, including. And what did we say on 22?
Madam Chair.
And adding.
I think that my recollection is we struck the including competitiveness and inserted the word congressional in the next phrase there, and adding competitiveness to the criteria for
in terms of what we did on 107. You're correct. Thank you. So the language to be added that you should there, okay, and adding competitiveness to the criteria for state legislative and congressional districts.
Yeah, I think you just have to, all right. You have to, I think we need to strike the comma before on line nine, before and adding.
Yes. And I think that's all I've got. So I would move those changes.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative.
We haven't adopted this.
Oh,
yet.
Yeah, you're right.
Into the
oh, you're right. Oh, getting so tired already.
I know.
All right, as it reads now, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning redistricting in Colorado and in connection therewith, replacing the Colorado Reapportionment Commission with a Colorado Redistricting Commission, directing the commission redistrict Colorado or congressional districts and state legislative districts, requiring the appointment of 12 commissioners, of whom at least four must be either a member of a minor political party or unaffiliated with any political party, prohibiting commissioners from being lobbyists or members of or candidates for either Congress or the state legislature, requiring the agreement of at least eight of 12 commissioners to approve any action of the commission, adopting existing criteria for congressional districts and adding competitiveness to the criteria for state legislative and congressional districts, requiring that only the nonpartisan staff of the commission may submit plans to the commission, and requiring that the commission's work be done in public meetings.
Do you have any comment? Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to add one word in line 11, insert the word solely, S-O-L-E-Y, between, after the word done and before in, done solely in public meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I'm satisfied the way it is. That's the language we've used in the other initiatives, which I don't want to add something in that makes it qualified when that's...
This is consistent with 107. I will ask my colleagues whether or not Congress should be capitalized per your. I think that is a proper noun in that.
Doesn't change my reading, so I you understand. Can do whatever you want.
Trying to defeat the rehearing for next week.
Oh. I don't know if that's going to do it. I think there's going to be a line.
On line six, I would move that we capitalize the word Congress.
I think it is right, actually.
Do I get a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. So I would move that we adopt the title for proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 132, as it was read, and it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 133.
The redistricting of state legislative districts in Colorado.
Who are
creative.
You?
It is single.
I move that proposed initiative 2015-2016-133 constitutes a single subject and we proceed to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. Yeah, Mr. Bergman, you had a comment?
Yes, on line one, I'd like to commit to insert a capital S on state and capital L for legislative redistricting, as well as any subsequent places where it does occur, such as the end of line two, state senatorial, and line three, representative districts.
I'm fine with how it is. I don't think that's correct.
Okay. In line five, after U.S., capitalize House and capitalize representatives. Propose that.
I mean, I think we can just incorporate your comments from the last one. I'm fine the way it is. So.
I'm fine with the capitalization issue. Okay. I do have a question for Speaker McNulty regarding the single subject. What we say the single subject is, and that's because in section three of this measure, I know that these changes are based on existing provisions that you've now moved, but you are now moving provisions dealing with congressional redistricting, and so I'm sort of debating whether the single subject is state legislative redistricting when your measure is actually also making changes to provisions dealing with congressional redistricting?
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Eubanks. There are different pieces of this that were used to in the drafting process and to help accommodate an easier read of the ballot initiative. They're not substantive changes, but rather changes made in the drafting process in order to ensure that the initiative reads as simply and clearly as possible.
So you would argue that the measure still is just dealing with state legislative
redistricting? Substantively, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You want to make some
changes?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And they're similar to ones we've done on some of the other titles. Line three, to replace the word four with the number four. And the word 12 with 12, the number 12. I think we'd change House of Representatives on line five to Congress, and that would be capitalized. So it'd be U.S. Congress.
We've just used Congress, right?
No, we used U.S. Congress.
Did we in the last one?
Well, on the last one, we just used Congress, but on the earlier staff draft, it had U.S. The last measure didn't have reference to
the state, right? Or
U.S. It didn't have the reference to
okay.
U.S.
Okay. Okay. I get it.
Okay, line six, to replace the word eight with the number eight. Line seven, strike 12, place it with number 12. Okay, I'm stumped here, just trying to keep all the measures together. So we're dealing just with state legislative districts. We're just adding competitiveness to state legislative district redistricting. Is that correct, Speaker McNulty?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Dan Bergman again. Okay, can I ask why we changed the word 8 to the numeral 8 and the word 12 to the numeral 12? On line six?
Because it's our general practice in titles to have numerals rather than the numbers spelled out.
The numbers spelled out. Okay, I would also argue that it is clearer to the voter.
In terms of having the numerals?
Correct.
Yes.
Just as capitalization is, too. So I would move that.
So noted.
Thank you, ma'am. I would move that in line six after the word 12. Commissioner be capitalized. And so as we capitalized Congress after U.S. So it was a proper name dealing a specific body.
Yeah, I'm fine the way it is. So do you want to continue?
Sure. And I think I have one other question for the proponents. And again, just trying to keep all the different measures straight. Should we have something in the title regarding judicial review of an adopted plan for this measure or not? We don't really... This staff draft doesn't include something along those lines, and whether it should or.
Madam Chair, we didn't include that in 107. You did include it. It was included in the staff draft on 128. Was not included in 132, and probably isn't. And I don't think that it's necessary here.
Okay. So again, you're pointing out our inconsistencies. which is fine.
But each initiative is different, and each initiative brings its own issues to the table, and different issues are prioritized differently within each one of these.
Okay, I just wanted to ask whether you thought that was something that needed to be included.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think those are all the changes that I have. So I would go ahead and move the changes that are reflected on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, so... Right now it reads, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning state legislative redistricting and in connection therewith restructuring the state commission that sets boundaries for state senatorial and representative districts to require that at least four of the 12 commissioners be affiliated with a minor political party or unaffiliated with any political party, prohibiting commissioners from being registered lobbyists or members or candidates for the U.S. Congress or the Colorado Legislature, requiring the agreement of at least 8 of 12 commissioners to approve any action of the commission, adding competitiveness as the final criteria to be used in drawing state legislative districts, establishing a procedure to set legislative district boundaries if the commission is unable to adopt a plan, and requiring that the commission's work be done in public meetings.
I would move that we adopt the title for proposed initiative 2015-2016-133 as it appears on the screen and as it was read.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. We're going to take a really quick recess, like 5 minutes.
Thank you, members of the board. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Thank you, Mr. Ward.
Thank you.
We'll start on something else. Side three. All right, we are back on the record. And the next item on the agenda is proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 134. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. My name is Scott Gessler. I am representing the proponents for ballot proposed ballot initiatives 134, 35, 36, and 37. And those are Horace Devine and Nicholas Hoover, who are here today in the third row towards your right.
And does anyone on the board have any questions on the single subject?
No.
No. No. Anybody signed up to talk on this, speak on this issue? No? Okay. All right. Well, want to make a motion?
Yes. I move that we find the proposed initiative 2015-16, number 134, concerning state minimum wage, has a single subject, and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. All right, that takes us to the staff draft. Do you have any comment on the language?
I do. So the language, well, as you well know, the titles are supposed to reflect, describe the central provisions of the ballot initiative. This title reflects and describes every provision of the ballot initiative. So it's a little bit over-particularized with too much detail. And I don't have exact language, but I do have conceptually what we'd suggest. And that is to say, you know, the minimum wage will increase in annual increments to $10.10 per hour effective January 1st, and then be adjusted annually for inflation thereafter. And then eliminating the tipped, essentially tipped credit or the tipped offset. Again, conceptually saying it increases in annual increments to $6.50 on January 2019 and then is adjusted for inflation thereafter. Because putting every single dollar amount for every single benchmark gets, I think, very confusing. And I have difficulty understanding reading it, and I drafted it. So I think it's just far too much detail in there. It can be shortened and still convey the central ideas.
Okay. Is there anybody here who wishes to speak on the title language?
Okay. I also have a conceptual thought while we're on that. Is it really central to talk about eliminating the offset, referencing that in specific language, as opposed to just saying, having a parallel provision for essentially two minimum wages, a regular one and a tipped minimum wage, and just saying what they are?
I'd support that approach.
Okay.
I'd very much support that approach.
Do you have language?
I do.
Okay.
And we can probably, I think, first, before we start with that, do we...
Connection therewith?
There is an in connection therewith.
Oh, there is? Okay.
But do we think that we don't... If we don't want to specify all the amounts, because I did think we could just say, you know, for the year rather than these effective January 1st, like 4/2017, 4/18, 4/19, which shortens things, but I'm not at all opposed to.
Do you remember what we did last time? We've set one of these before.
Yeah, so the last one didn't have the level of detail in the steps, but it simply said it shall be, you didn't even use the in connection therewith.
Yeah, I didn't
language.
Think so.
So I cheered at that decision. That one was very short and simply said, shall it increase it to X dollars and then on such and such a day and then be adjusted annually thereafter? So it was one sentence, and it was a very short sentence at that. And that's why I think, you know, there will be a pretty clear distinction when you say there will be annual step increases to January 2019 this month and then for inflation thereafter.
So I think we'll do right now is I have Steve just putting in my language, but then we can cut out, which just shortens the steps, and then we can cut out and that, I think, and do the annual increment, and I think we'll have quite a bit shorter title in both ways.
And maybe we can get rid of the in connection and just do the increasing if we get it.
I don't think the last one addressed the tipped wage at all. I think here we have
two things. I mean, they're certainly, I think, necessarily and properly connected, but to me, I think the in connection there, I think there's enough here that we probably should keep it, but.
That's fine.
Certainly.
It just kills me. Why not 10, 11?
Why 10, 10?
Why 59 cents? I'm the lawyer, I'm not the economist.
60 cents, 60 cents, 59 cents.
I am, like I say, I'm the lawyer and not the economist on this one.
40 cents, 40 cents, 40 cents. Because we would have said 60 cents each year, except for the fact that it's 10, 10.
Well, $10.10 is so much easier to calculate than $10.11. So.
Except that's 59 cents, and the only thing that's inconsistent in the.
Yeah, otherwise we could say increase by 60%, 60 cents annually.
Every year thereafter, adjusted by inflation.
Yeah, I looked at that, and. We could say about 60 cents.
He gets to challenge you.
I'm waiting for the suggested language.
Go ahead.
No, it's just one of these days it's going to occur to me to have enough time to send this stuff to Steve in advance.
Did you have enough time?
No.
Oh, I was going to say.
We just adopt that for now and then work off of it.
Yeah.
All right. Move we adopt the language that appears on the screen for working purposes.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So, and what I suspect we can do, though I haven't figured it out quite yet, based on Mr. Gessler's suggestion now, is probably, and maybe we can't even get rid of the in connection though, if I'm not sure, but, you know, something like increasing the state minimum wages in connection therewith, and then I think we can say something like respectively in one clause and then do the annual adjusting of both of them like respectively and get rid of having two parallel clauses if we're going with sort of annual increment language.
But what about the suggestion that we just say incrementally until it reaches, or what was your language?
Right.
You just wanted to point out that in 2019, it would be $10.10.
Yeah, my suggestion was that it increases, we could say incrementally or in annual increments.
Annually, okay.
Because that does get the annual part in there, to $10.10 per hour in 2019, and for tipped employees to $6, and right. Well, for regular employees, $10.10, and for tipped employees, $6.50 on January 1st, 2019, and annually adjusting them,
right,
or both, for inflation thereafter. So I do think that shortens it with that parallelism.
And I think we can do it to one clause. Even so, I think we can say something like increasing the state regular minimum wage and minimum wage for tipped employees in annual increments to $10.10 per hour and $6.50 per hour, respectively, for 2019, and annually adjusting them for inflation thereafter.
I think that works very well.
That.
Okay.
the the master of Microsoft Word.
So hit me with that again, please.
Oh, sure. Okay, so considering the state minimum wages and connecting there with increasing the state regular minimum wage and the state tipped employee minimum wage. In annual increments to 10.10 per hour and 6.50 per hour, respectively, I guess we'd now it gets a little trickier. It's like beginning. It's a little hard to get the increments and then get to the 2019 date. I'm trying to figure out how to
maybe
get there.
Annually? We have annual.
Maybe say per hour respectively on January 1st, 2019, or
By 2019.
By 2019. And annually adjusting them for inflation thereafter.
Yeah. Then just on line 7, it to them.
So I guess we're to the question of could we just say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution increasing.
I would fully support that approach.
It's just do you have any concerns about the and, you know, versus make it?
I think from the language standpoint, it's pretty clear for people to read, and people thoroughly understand that, you know, just reading it.
And I think the last measure increased it annually for inflation.
Yeah, the last measure did have those two provisions, a certain dollar amount and then annual inflation.
Right. Well, what I'm more concerned about is I don't think the last one dealt with the tipped employees at all.
It didn't, no.
So we've got two different things, and that's why I had the minimum wages, which I know is, and it's kind of like, to me, almost like sales and use tax. They're so connected that it's the same thing. But, you know, it's more a single subject concern for the proponent.
I think we're okay with single subject, to be honest, because it – I say there's case law to support it because the original constitutional minimum wage that went into effect in 2006 did have those two separate provisions, regular and tipped.
Let me rephrase. I don't think that we have a substantive single subject problem. I just want to make sure the title doesn't make it look like we're talking.
I understand.
Multiple subjects.
Well, you could say increasing the minimum wage for regular and tipped employees.
Yeah.
So maybe just put minimum wage first. Increasing the minimum wage for regular, or the increasing the state minimum wage for regular and tipped employees, and that may address your concern.
I'm still well. Despite myself, I still think we need to say minimum wages. There are two things, even though they're the same. But I'm more comfortable with that anyways.
Wage.
No, I think we do have to say wages, don't you think? I mean, they're two different. They're a single subject for our purposes, I think, but there are two different things.
I'm okay with it. Either way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't have any comments.
Okay.
I'm good with it.
All right, you want to?
Sure. Just move to adopt the changes they appear on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, so the question as it is right now is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution increasing the state minimum wages for regular and tipped employees in annual increments to $10.10 per hour and $6.50 per hour, respectively, by 2019, and annually adjusting them for inflation thereafter.
Awesome. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16, number 134, as we've amended the staff draft and it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 135.
I can, again, for the record, Scott Gessler, representing the two proponents, Horace Devine and Nicholas Hoover. I can make representations, and I understand that these may not have legally binding force, but the proponents only plan or will only be ultimately seeking ballot access for only one of the 134 through 137 ballot initiatives. When you look at number 135, its single subject, again, is the increase in the state minimum wage. In this instance, it differs from 134 and basically one provision. The regular is increased annually for inflation. However, the tipped amount goes to $6.50 per hour, but then is then we adopt the federal tipped minimum wage thereafter. So the differences are, for the regular, it remains essentially the same. The difference is the tipped is $6.50 on January 1st, 2017, and then the federal tipped minimum wage thereafter. So we lose the elegance and parallelism.
And you gain a concerning connection therewith.
I'm not.
Yeah, we need to do single subject.
Yeah. The challenge is just sort of the different dates because we don't have the increments on the one. I mean, I think, other than that, the language can be reconciled.
We want to move single subject first?
Sorry, yes. I move the proposed initiative 2015-16, number 135, has a single subject.
And I don't have anybody signed up to speak.
And that we have jurisdiction set of time.
Does anybody wish to speak on this? No. Okay.
Second the motion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
So you think we can use the old one and modify it? Or you want to start with the staff draft?
I don't want to start with the staff draft.
Okay. Well, then I guess we'll start with the old one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just do have to do prices separate clauses, unfortunately.
Right.
But
so should we put back in the concerning and in connection?
Yeah, and I think he's got it there already. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, the language we just did for 134 works for the first half.
Right.
And then you just have to do
the clip out
separate
the
clause. Semicolon and
so instead
adopting
of and,
650 and thereafter, the federal minimum wage.
Well, the one difficulty is we have the 650 coming in to a there's no increment, it just comes right in.
Right.
So the 650 on January.
So I think we have to just say increasing for regular employees. Take out the end tipped on line two. And then I think you can just say wage right before that because it's now it's just one of them. And we got semicolon there. And then, unfortunately, I have to repeat a little bit, I think. Say something like, increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees to $6.50 per hour. What I would suggest is to the lesser of $6.50 per hour or the amount of the federal tipped employee minimum wage. Just say by 2017. Then I think on line three after per hour,
on the first clause, you probably just need to also say by 2019.
Then let's see. Then we only have the inflation adjustment for the regular one on this one. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So on line.
If I may say so, it says increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees would be $6.50 per hour.
Language?
Yeah, I don't think the lesser language works because it's $6.50 until. January,
right. Got you.
2017, and then it adopts the federal minimum wage if it increases or when it is above $6.50. Maybe say, and then adopting the federal minimum wage if greater
right.
thereafter. I don't know if that quite works, that language.
Well, actually, it's two or something. It's,
wouldn't it be increasing? It's definitely not lesser.
No, it's, I got back. but it's
but
the greater
I'm not,
of, isn't it?
It's well, the greater it's, of after 2017. Yeah, after January 1st, 2017, it's the greater
but
of.
But we don't make any change until January 1st, 2017. It's a one-time change.
Correct.
So
correct.
As of January 1st, 2017,
well, yeah.
It's the greater of 650 or whatever the feds are charging.
Well, and this goes into effect in January 1st, 2017. So we may not even need the 2017 language.
Even better.
Because the entire initiative goes into effect on January 1st, 2017. So it increases the minimum wage for tipped employees to $6.50 per hour and then adopts the federal minimum wage if greater.
That's where I was
after.
Going. Increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees to $6.50 per hour on, I think the date's important, January 1, 2017. And there, or, let's see, not,
and then adopt
the federal minimum wage if greater than $6.50 thereafter.
Correct. Do you need the 2017 for the minimum wage? Because this doesn't even go into effect until January 1st, 2017.
You don't tell anybody that.
I guess.
The only date we have before that is 19.
I think it is.
For the
I'm happy to lose that vote, but
I'm
I think
talking
it is.
About.
Yeah, I mean, when you say we don't need to use 2017, if we didn't use it, then everybody would believe this was 2019 because that's the only other date we reference.
Okay.
We never say when this is effective.
Fair enough.
So, and now we need to, on line four at the beginning, we need to say. Well, the way that I had suggested it be read was increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees to $6.50 per hour on January 1, 2017, and to the federal tipped employee minimum wage, if greater thereafter.
I guess why?
And so maybe and adopting the federal minimum wage.
That'd be fine too.
Thereafter. If greater,
it's
you got to fit the if greater.
It's a fact that it goes to $6.50 on January 1, 2017, and then something overcomes that after the fact at some unknown moment in time.
Correct.
Ask Mr. Gessler a question.
Yes,
if on January 1st, 2017, the federal minimum wage is $8 an hour, what happens?
We would adopt the federal minimum wage.
So it's just as soon as it goes into effect, it's the greater of the two. I just had my lesser because I'm back.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So on January 1st, 2017, adopting the federal, you know, making it either $6.50
or just whichever one is higher is which one applies, right?
So basically, it becomes the greater of $6.50 or the federal minimum wage.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Okay, you want
to? Yeah, that's fine. I'm fine with that too.
Suggest.
I think they say the same thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
now because Lloyd's sat down.
Hey. You just need to get rid of the and adopt it. And I think then on line 3, after 219, you just have to add the clause about the inflation adjustment. Just between and adjusting it annually for inflation thereafter. And then I think all you have to do instead of a semicolon, I think it's just an and. So. No, not there above, because there's nothing below now. See what I mean? So at that, right, at that thereafter on line 3, I think you just go to and then you end it right there. I'm pretty sure.
Let me throw out the idea of inputting annually for inflation thereafter and increasing as of January 1, 2017, the state minimum wage.
Sure.
It reads very oddly at the end.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Yeah, on January 1st, maybe instead of as of.
And then putting just a period. So basically just move the date. The effective date
to right
up to the front of the clause rather than at the end. So stick it in after increasing on line 4.
After increasing or after and? Doesn't matter.
You don't, either.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I put and on January 1st, 2017, increasing.
It's fine. I think that reads much more clearly.
Yeah. And just got it. And then just a comma after 2017.
You want to do January 1st, 2019, or do you think it's fine? Just don't know if it implies it could happen any time in 2019 because we don't put a month there and we put one later. Maybe it doesn't matter.
You could say on 29th.
Well, but I just don't know if you want to say January 1st. It doesn't matter to me.
We used the by in the last one.
Okay.
That was similar, so I just...
Right.
All
right, so the way it is right now, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the state minimum wage and in connection therewith increasing the state minimum wage for regular employees in annual increments to $10.10 an hour per hour by 2019 and adjusting it annually for inflation thereafter and on January 1st, 2017, increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees to the greater of $6.50 per hour or the federal tipped employee minimum wage.
Do you need any semicolons in there?
Can never have enough.
I'm just thinking those ands tend to run together.
I don't know what semicolon. Maybe a comma after the end on line 3?
Yeah, after 2019. And then another one.
After another the thereafter.
Comma, maybe after the thereafter.
Tweet thereafter. And...
suggest one more tweak.
Sure.
Increasing the state minimum wage for tipped employees to $6.50 per hour or the federal tipped minimum wage if greater.
That fine works. With me.
No objection.
It removes 3 or 4 words. It's always a good thing.
I understand.
Does it? Does it just put them at the end?
It's still a fact that it goes up to $6.50 in 2017. That's the significance of it. That's what people need to understand. And when you put in this or clause, this disjunctive, it's confusing. It's only the disjunctive only triggers if it's greater. Therefore, greater should modify that.
We weren't arguing with you.
I'm explaining it for the record.
We're admiring you.
Mr. Gessler is mocking me.
No, I'm not. I'm not mocking you. I'm dead serious that it's good to remove a few words.
Be careful. He might break out a Brian Garner bobblehead.
I have one of those on my shelf. As you.
We know. I'm
good with that.
All right. Do you want to move it?
Yes. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16, number 135, as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 136.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Gessler. I represent the proponents, Mr. Horace Devine and Mr. Nicholas Hoover, who are here today in the third row for ballot initiative 136. The single subject is the increasing the state minimum wage and the differences or the central features here. It's $10.10 on January 1st, 2019, and adjusted annually for inflation, something we've seen before. And in this instance, it increases the offset for tip income up to $4.81 on January 1st, 2019.
I don't know how anyone signed up to speak on this. Is there anybody who wants to? No. You want to do single subject?
Sure. I move that we file the proposed initiative 2015-16, number 136, as a single subject, and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. So this is more like 134. And then we're just changing the. What are we changing?
So the changes are in the tipped employee area, and basically the offset increases until January, and the offset increases in annual increments to $4.81 on January 1st, 2019. Without any adjustment clause after that.
Oh. Okay. So.
I think it's closer to 135 than 134.
Yeah. Very similar to 135. So if I may suggest that we start with the 135 title that was just approved and maybe tweak that.
It was me.
So, Stephen, I think you can strike everything from line 3 and on all the way through if greater. I think none of that is relevant. While I look at the proponent, no.
Not the adjusting part.
Keep the adjusted for inflation part. And then I think you can strike all the way down except the strike through beginning at the end of line 3 all the way through line 6 to the semicolon.
Could you clarify that?
Right where the cursor is.
Strike that and above.
Strike backwards up through concerning at the end of line 3. We're building Frankenstein. So get rid of all that.
Okay.
Now let's start there.
we just sort of, so basically what we want to use is kind of the first clause or the first part until we get into the listings and then do just do the annual increments bit. And I don't think there's not an inflation adjustment on the tipped, is there? No.
Correct.
So then I think we just say increasing the amount of tip income that an employer may use to offset the minimum wage of tipped employees. And you can get rid of the who regularly receive tips.
Offset's already in the statute, right? That's not something we have to deal with.
Correct. May I also suggest that you remove the clause on line 4 that an employer may use? Because if someone has wages, they're working for someone else. So I would almost argue that that is unnecessary. Well, not almost. I'd argue that's unnecessary language.
So you want to say like that offsets,
mm-hmm.
or I mean, it doesn't read,
or maybe simply like used to offset. I know that's passive tense, but it does remove several of the words.
Yeah, but that's what's in the statute. Used to offset the wage of employees who regularly receive tips.
You know, we can get rid of the employer, but I think just that may be used tracking the measure makes a lot of sense. Steve, I just think that may be used. And then I think we just sort of strike all this specificity right from just get rid of all that, and then I think we do in annual increments to what was it, 650 by whatever,
481.
I'm sorry, 481. And by 2019.
Per hour, right? By 2019.
Yeah.
481 per hour.
I don't know that we need this semicolon after thereafter because there's only two things. I don't know if we need to do that. I don't care really either way. Otherwise, it looks good to me.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yep. Let me read it. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the state minimum wage and in connection therewith increasing the state minimum wage for regular employees in annual increments to $10.10 per hour by 2019 and adjusting it annually for inflation thereafter, and increasing the amount of tip income that may be used to offset the minimum wage of tipped employees in annual increments to $4.81 per hour by 2019.
I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16 number 136 as we've amended the staff draft and it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. That takes us to 137.
Okay. For the record, my name is Scott Gessler. I represent the two proponents, Mr. Horace Devine and Mr. Nicholas Hoover, who are both here today for proposed ballot initiative number 137. The single subject is that it increases the state minimum wage. With respect to the ballot title language, this is very similar to number 134, the same number, the same annual increment. increases. However, after, instead of being adjusted for annual inflation, instead of being annually adjusted for inflation, as number 134 is, this adopts the federal minimum wage if it is greater for both of those variants of the state minimum wage.
I've never seen this many similar initiatives that are this different.
We, our goal is to provide new and stimulating experiences for the title board.
So just to be clear, Mr. Gessler, this only contemplates the federal minimum wage option kicking in once we've hit 1010 at the state level, right? So if, say, in 2018, we're at $9.51 and the federal is $11, we don't use the federal. It's only after that point, right?
Yes, that's our interpretation of it. So we're locked into the state scheme or the state approach until 2019.
So you max it out, and then if the federal gets higher,
then we look
you go
at the
with the federal. Okay.
Which, realistically, if the federal is higher than the state, we're subject
right.
to federal law.
Which one do you want to start with?
Don't we want to start with 134?
Either 134 or 35.
Yeah,
I think it's a combination of the.
I think it's 134 because you have that same parallelism.
Yeah,
available.
We have the respectively, and then we change the
right.
the way it raises for both.
But 135 is the one, right, where we adopted the if greater based on the federal.
Yeah.
Correct.
So it's the second clause from 135.
Applicable to both.
Joined together into 134.
So what appears on the board right now is 134 without the inflation adjustment?
Yeah. So then go to 135 and cut that last thing, and then we'll use some of that.
All right, where do you want to go from here?
So just cut that in and let's take a look at what, I mean, I know it's not going to be right, but.
It's.
Oh, okay. It's there. Okay, so then we just say, and. Adjusting.
Or perhaps, and then adopting the federal minimum wage for each, if greater. Or, and thereafter, adopting the federal minimum wage, if greater.
Yeah. And thereafter, adopting the federal minimum wage, if greater. Let's take a look at that and then.
And then remove the from line three where after 2019 to the middle of line four where it begins the and thereafter.
Oop. Yep. We have a comma, if greater?
We did.
Thank you.
just trying to figure out, I think that the if greater sort of makes it clear if greater than what, but.
I don't know, David, that one's yours. Did you want to justify your grammar?
No, because it doesn't work here. Because now you're modifying. You don't have that to modify. That's what you're struggling with.
Yes. Well, is it a legitimate struggle, or are we good with the language?
I'm good with it.
Okay, then right now it reads an amendment to the Colorado Constitution increasing the state minimum wages for regular and tipped employees in annual increments of $10.10 per hour and $6.50 per hour, respectively, by 2019, and thereafter adopting the federal minimum wage if greater.
Okay. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16, number 137, as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right.
Thank you very much.
That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 138.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elizabeth Titus. With the law firm of Hogan Lovells, on behalf of the designated representatives Scott Martini and Sean Martini and Scott Prestige, who are both here in attendance and have provided their affidavits. The single subject of proposed Measure 138 is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution that would authorize local governments to adopt local laws regulating oil and gas development that are no more restrictive or do not conflict with state law.
What else is there?
That's it.
I mean, what could you adopt? You could adopt, I mean, if they're no more restrictive.
Well, there's existing local authority to regulate oil and gas operations, part of the zoning authority, but this would codify in the Colorado Constitution that authority could not exceed state authority, essentially.
Okay.
I mean, it's an open question before the Colorado Supreme Court right now to the extent to which local governments can impose regulations.
Okay. Do you have any questions?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Do you want to make a motion? Or is there anybody signed up? I don't have anyone signed up to speak, but is there anyone?
Did we do single subject?
No, but that's why I'm asking. If anybody wants to speak on single subject? No? Okay. So.
All right. Then I would move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-16, number 138, concerning local regulation of oil and gas development, has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Do you have any comments on the language of the title?
I like the staff draft.
I went back and looked at one we set for something that was fairly similar to this in the past, number 122 from the last cycle. And I think a couple of things that we talked about were, the laws and regulations, which I believe the staff draft just references laws. I think I'd like to make sure we add that in. The other thing was that we say local governments here. Local governments is broader than what we're talking about here. It only talks about municipalities and counties, so municipalities and counties. So I might say something like municipal and county governments rather than local, to not give the implication that we're giving some authority to special districts and on the whole myriad of other local governments we have around the state.
Okay. Would you mind reading what we did on 120?
Sure. This is 2013-14, number 122, and that title was an amendment to the Colorado Constitution stating that local governments may enact and enforce local laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development or operations. And it was a little different. Only if the laws or regulations are no more restrictive than and do not exceed or conflict with state law.
Well, I mean, how do you feel about using that language and then adding in the municipal and county? And
yeah, and that's,
I mean, my problem with it is it sounds like, you know, authorizing local governments to do something, but really it's
sort of acknowledging that.
Yeah, it's not really authorizing them to do anything they can't already. It's not expanding anything they can do. And the word authorizing sort of makes it sound like,
yeah,
they're going to be authorized to do something.
Yes. Yeah, but actually just try that.
Can I make a comment about authorizing, or not the authorizing, the municipal and county governments? I mean, I haven't compared the list in 138 versus some of the other local control ballot measures that we have, but I think they are similar. And I believe in the other title set this session that used the word local governments. And so that will perhaps, you know, that will create confusion. Well, this measure says local governments, but this one says municipal and county governments. Seems like we should be consistent.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, even if we did want to make it clear that we weren't including special districts, adding that language wouldn't do that because I don't think most people really even understand the makeup of local governments or associate special districts with local government. And I don't want to make it seem like that is a difference in the initiatives, because clearly these would conflict, and I'd like people to know what the conflicts are.
I mean, I guess that's right. To the extent we've been less precise in the past, then it's not the end of the world. It was just a thought. So is that the feeling that we just keep local governments?
You okay with local, David?
Yes.
Okay. So is this 122, Steve? Is that what we have up?
This is my
this
language I came up with, which is very close to 122.
Okay.
I mean, this stating is the same as 122. The enact and enforce is from 122. Let me check one thing. And actually, we had local in 122 also, which I don't think I had. May act and enforce local laws and regulations.
Can I suggest that we change?
And then otherwise, the only thing that's... go ahead.
We struck county, so that typo got fixed. Okay. Striking only if and putting in so long as. It addresses your point, because it sounds like you're authorizing them to do something when in fact you're restricting them from doing something. And the significance of this then becomes the local government's authority to occupy the space below the state rules is constitutional in nature as opposed to statutory. It takes away the authority for the legislature to find that it's an interest of statewide concern. That's what it does. But it also, by constitution, caps it. I mean, that's the difference. I'm not sure it's a difference. It's maybe a difference without much distinction, but I don't, that's not for me to decide. But I think that's what it does. You may disagree, I guess.
No, I don't disagree.
Well, what do you think of this language?
I think I'm fine with stating that. May enact and enforce is a, we use that in the measure, so that's also fine. I think local laws and regulations regulating is awkward.
What did we say here?
I think what was concerning last time. I think regulations are included within the broader category of local laws. So I don't know that and regulations is necessary. I think it just doesn't really add much value, but.
So last time, Steve, in that regulations, we used regulations concerning.
For that very reason,
I
suspect.
Yeah, it was awkward, yeah. So.
And conflict with state laws, regulation. I'm fine with that.
Thank
you. I'm fine with it too. Do you have any other changes? So, on the screen we have an amendment to the Colorado Constitution stating that local governments may enact and enforce local laws and regulations concerning oil and gas development or operations so long as the laws and regulations are no more restrictive than and do not conflict with state laws or regulations.
I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16 number 138 as we've amended the staff draft and it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us. Thank you. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2015 number 114.
Thank you. I'm Darcy Straub, the first proponent of Initiative 114. The second proponent is Jane Straub in the fourth row wearing the red shirt. And we have previously submitted our affidavits.
Okay. Looks pink from here. His shirt.
Pardon?
I said his shirt looks pink from here.
Yeah, I think the Rockies might have actually beat the Reds today if he only worn a purple shirt instead of a red shirt. So live and learn.
Do you want to start by telling us what the single subject of your initiative is?
Yes, to prevent the government from violating the Establishment Clause by defining marriage in either support or opposition to any religious belief.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody signed up or anyone who wishes to speak on this initiative? Right. Any questions from the board or discussion on single subject?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would say that while this measure says quite a bit, I do think it has a single subject. You know, I don't think that the new constitutional provision sort of has a lot of legal effect since the state, you know, has to respect federal constitutional requirements regardless. You know, the declarations are declarations, and I think that the substantive statutory provisions in the new proposed section 1416.103, you know, all seem necessarily and properly connected to getting the government out of marriage. And everything else looks like clarification. So while it's a little bit tricky to follow all the parts, I do think it's a single subject.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have issues with the language in the staff draft and how necessary some of it is, but I agree that it's the initiative itself is connected in a single subject.
I don't disagree.
Okay, so motion, Jason?
Yes. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-16, number 114, has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
Yes, I have a couple of amendments I'd like to propose. In line 3, after defining marriage and before the comma, I'd like to see the language that consequently either supports or opposes any religious belief.
Yeah, I don't think that that is, I mean, I was actually going to suggest shortening that initial clause. So generally, we like to keep that first clause very tight and then everything in the trailer.
Yeah, but this really isn't about establishing religion. I mean, nowhere in there is...
Oh, I was going to strike that. So.
Yeah, well, can we put up the language and see how it reads first?
You can, but I'm just telling you, I'm not going to... I don't know if anybody else... going to support that. Do you want them to put up the language?
Let's see your language, because it may be, it may subsume his suggestion.
Well, I was going to suggest that just in a in looking at it overall, this is really about the effect, which is defining marriage. Whether or not it's a violation of the Establishment Clause, whether or not it's the establishment of religion, none of that is actually what it does. And so my suggestion was that we look at what the initiative does instead of what it's theoretically trying to prevent philosophically.
And I struggled with it because it just says respect the U.S. version thereof. And that's essentially what the... And then it puts in a statute. I think I'm going to your point from single subject. If you read the constitutional, it says the state of Colorado shall respect the establishment, equal protection, and due process clauses of the U.S. Constitution for issues concerning civil unions and marriages. I mean, I think we have to do that regardless by law, but this is expressly saying that, and then we have a whole series of statutes defining that, and that's where I start getting...
I think.
May I approach and give you a copy of draft language?
Certainly.
Sure.
And if I may first, before, I think there's one thing I'd like to do that's low-hanging fruit and technical before we get into the meat. As I think, you know, this is one of those fairly unusual initiatives that amends both the Constitution and the statutes. I think to comply with our new title requirements and how we describe changes to the statutes, I think on line 1 it needs to say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution and a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes.
Right.
That just puts us in compliance with our new statutory requirements.
Oh, you drafters. It's fine.
You have a suggestion on the top line?
On the single subject, I do have a suggestion. I think I agree with the general tenor of the board that the explanatory language isn't really the subject. We should look at what this does and would suggest a single subject along the lines of either the elimination of or alternatively a prohibition against government involvement in marriage. Because that's what I think the measure is actually trying to do, and I...
Right, and you mentioned the Establishment Clause, and if you notice on the amendment language, I mean, there are two words I suggest there. One is violation, and perhaps that's too strong, because I didn't bring a note from a judge saying that issuing marriage licenses violates the Establishment Clause, but I can make the argument that perhaps the Establishment Clause has been neglected in this issue. And if you think about it, I mean, most, if not all, religious beliefs have some position on same-sex marriages, and it's hard to avoid that issue as an establishment clause. I mean, either you support it or you don't. And when the government goes ahead and, as it did in the Obergefell case, and adopted a position that supports same-sex marriage, all of a sudden it's disparaging those religious beliefs that do not support same-sex marriage. So the Establishment Clause, I think, is arguably at play here.
I think what the board wants to clarify is that what's difficult here is, while that, without expressing an opinion on that, what we need to set a title to isn't so much the reasons for why you're running the initiative, but just what it actually does. And, you know, my preliminary thought in reading is that what it actually does is it prohibits the government from having involvement in marriage. And why it does that may be important. It may be a great argument, you know, for the campaign, mm-hmm. or a reason for a person to vote for or against the initiative, but I don't know that it's something that matters for the title.
And I think instead of that general language about marriage, I think it is limited to defining marriage, because I think the government is still involved in marriage and property and all kinds of other things.
Well, see,
but not defining.
In the end, let me actually back up. I mean, in the end, there's a little bit of a battle or issue over the word marriage, because the word marriage actually occurs within various religious authorities. In fact, there's an issue out in Albert County where a clerk went ahead and, you know, put up a poster that took a verse from the Bible that quoted marriage, and people had an uproar over that, and so that poster needed to come down. So the word marriage, being in various religious authorities, should be given some degree of credibility. And
well, maybe it's
so
the
that's
legal
how we
definition.
Kind of draw oh. in the Establishment Clause. Right. I mean, that you can go ahead and look at marriage as, you know, a common English word, but there is a religious connotation associated with it, and that's kind of at play when, you know, when you go ahead and everybody here has probably attended a wedding and seen a marriage in a church.
Yes. Let me ask this question, though. As I understand it, and this is where I may disagree with Ms. Stiart, is would your proposed initiative, if enacted, essentially anything, I mean, it's not changing like all those property rights and all these various things, but you're just saying all those people who are in those, it's, we're treating them as civil unions, we're not treating them as marriage anymore. Government's out of marriage because that word has religious connotations and we don't want to mess with it at all.
Right.
Is that what you're trying to do?
Right. And if you actually want to be thought of as being married or wish to get married, say like if you're a same-sex couple and you wish to get married, there are various churches or faiths which will accommodate you. So to me, that's important to realize that you aren't really taking anything away from same-sex couples. I mean, same-sex couples probably wouldn't go to a Mormon church to get married, but they could go to a Unitarian church to get married. So I mean, the government goes ahead and regulates civil unions, but they're careful not to use the word marry or marriage or any variation of that, which occurs in the Bible. And so you have a clean split between the government regulating couples, but also respecting marriages as a religious institution in accordance with various people's religious beliefs. So basically, why I like the language that I propose is it gives a general theme that I think is readily understandable by the voters. And, you know, it's like, make the point. Are the voters actually going to read all of that? I can barely read all of that, and I'm interested in it. So to me, it's important to really kind of get the theme out there initially, and it's easily understood. It makes the point, and then, you know, the voters can gloss over the rest of it. And, you know, it's like there'll probably be attention over this and, you know, people will have a general idea about it. But I think that statement or first initial statement that I propose is successful in concisely stating what this is about. If you beg to differ, you know, that's fine. You have the authority to change it. At least
well,
I made you think.
Are we kind of redefining a union between two people as a civil union and prohibiting government from, I mean, is that what we're doing?
I'm trying to figure out how you get as easily as you do to your articulation as trying to get government out.
Yeah.
It by its plain language, it doesn't, is my read of it. All it says is we shall respect the, and I'll insert, interpretations of the establishment equal protection and due process clauses. And then
right. What
the rest of what the statutes attempt to do is then assign various interpretations, which aren't actually interpretations out there in Supreme Court doctrine or anywhere else. This is where I struggle with, I don't know what it really does. What it does is, what the one clear thing that it does for me is say, the state of Colorado shall respect federal clauses relevant to, or that you find to be relevant to, civil unions and marriages, whatever the heck those things mean.
Right, and that's...
I don't know what to do with that for purposes of a title. I really don't.
Right.
Just when I read this, I kind of went, I don't even know where to begin.
Right, that's a very benign statement. And I mean, it doesn't have any teeth. I mean, state of Colorado has to respect every provision. So, right, I mean, I drafted that because I was concerned about unintended...
I put teeth behind it in the language of the revisions to Title 14, and it differs in there. You have some very specific things, and then there's some things in there that say, where's the one that I was just reading? It also respects an interpretation, essentially. I was hoping you guys would have brilliant ideas about how to deal with this one.
Right.
Clearly, my ideas have once again fallen short.
No, it's just
brilliant.
It's just a lot of this is very philosophical, and
exactly.
I'm not really
and
used to putting philosophy in the, a. I mean, I suppose if you're saying your initiative actually does nothing. Then I'm okay making a philosophical statement. But if you're telling me that your initiative is, allowing it's basically taking the word marriage out of the code almost, because it's saying that any person can define the word marriage however they want. And instead, the government can regulate civil unions and property and all those associated things, but it's really just going to be a contract. Government is no longer going to talk about marriage because only a person can define what a marriage is to them.
Right, and in some cases, it's in accordance with their religious beliefs based upon the word marriage occurring in various religious authorities.
Yeah. Unless the Establishment Clause, Equal Protection Clause, or Due Process Clause deal with marriages.
Well,
it's in the Constitution. It expressly doesn't take this out of marriages is the problem.
But then
because
when you...
we would have to respect whatever findings there might be of the Supreme Court interpreting those clauses as it relates to marriages. It's still binding on us.
Well, two of those...
where I get...
Yeah.
Two of those clauses have already been dealt with. The Obergefell case, or the same-sex marriage case, dealt with the due process and equal protection clauses. So that's why I included those in there, so legal experts can go ahead and say, oh, that's why those are there. Those maintain the rights that same-sex couples won in a hard-fought battle in that Supreme Court case. The Establishment Clause is put there because that issue was neglected as this issue progressed.
No, I understand the purpose. Mm-hmm. I understand the purpose that as a result of all of that happening out there in the free world, there's now a further, you're attempting to further an argument that the Establishment Clause, you can use the Establishment Clause to bifurcate marriage out of, and therefore kind of undermine the arguments that are made by the First Amendment trumping these other things. I get it. I think I get it. My problem is I don't know what this says. I understand your theory. I understand the logic. I understand what's undergirding this. I'm just not sure that it does it, because if it did it, I think I could say it. I'm just not sure that it.
Well,
the
do you
plain
think that,
language of it
do you
does
think,
what you're saying it does. It's a bit of a bootstrapping effort. When I read what's going into the Constitution, it's very hard for me to then get into everything in the statutory language because I'm not sure they're necessarily consistent with it. And that doesn't go to single subject. I think you have a single subject. I just don't know just don't know what this does.
Well, don't you think that
and
mostly...
therefore, it's hard for me to articulate.
Mostly what it does is what it's doing in the statute. So when you go to, like, line 8 of the trailers, I mean, the main thing it's doing is prohibiting the state or local government or courts from enacting or recognizing any law that implicitly or explicitly defines marriage.
Well,
is that what it's doing?
Unless the court says we have to, right? Because that's what the constitutional provision says. Let's assume the cases get overturned, right? And say, oh, nope, marriage between a man and a woman. Boom. That's it. I mean, that's just as much an eventuality as any of the others out there in the world. And it's not for us to predict that one way or the other. What the constitutional provision says is respect the U.S. constitutional case law when it comes to these three clauses, which I would argue we have to do regardless. So I'm not sure that has a lot of effect. The most important part of that provision is that it inserts the word marriage into the Constitution as it relates to those three clauses. In other words, in some ways, you may be working against yourself in some ways, because then the statutes, you try and write that out. I don't know how you...
What was your single subject, Jason?
Either the elimination of or alternatively a prohibition against government involvement in marriage. I mean, I guess the...
concerning marriage. No, we'll just do a trailer.
Well, maybe
that's
so.
That's kind of what I was... When you were saying that, I'm like, I think I agree with you that that is the subject. But it's hard for me... Maybe I'm looking behind it and I shouldn't be. And if that's the case, you guys should tell me to stop.
Well, I guess the question is, if there's no government action, how can it violate any of those constitutional prohibitions? I mean, I guess there could be are you saying, well, what if there's an affirmative duty to have state-sanctioned marriages? I mean,
between a man and a woman. I'll even more restrictive, right? The argument.
Let's say between anybody. I mean, what if the state just says, we're out of the marriage business, which is why I think this says. I mean, do we think that pure inaction is something that's going to trigger the constitutional provision in this? I mean, maybe we're getting too far down the weeds into effects. I don't know.
This is where I struggle, because I very quickly spiraled out of control in an effort to – I agree. There's a lot of words here. And I'm not sure we need a lot of words to describe
this. The staff draft has a lot of words. Well, and maybe it is that basic, and we say concerning marriage, and then saying in connection therewith, keeping government out of it, and essentially.
That's what I'm saying, concerning marriage.
But if we think there's a single subject, we have to set something, so.
I'd say concerning marriage, because we don't even know if it's keeping the government out of marriage, right? Because if the courts say you can regulate all these things, then you can do it.
Exactly.
So I think you have to just
I think the trailer, we largely just track the language of what we think is the most central to it. And
yeah.
Maybe that's the best we can do.
Right out of the initiative, because I don't know.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I'm fine with that. I don't know what else to do with it.
I really don't.
How about this? How about we start with concerning marriage? I will give Steve my much shorter trailer, and we'll start from there
okay.
And then move
Good
on.
Good idea.
That's great.
Here you go, Steve.
Starts down at the bottom. It'll take a little bit, I'm
All
afraid.
Right. Restroom.
Could you bring me back some water from the fountain when you come back?
Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't even know that.
So are you guys happy with that? What's up there?
What's that?
Okay.
With what was the staff draft? No.
No.
Nobody's okay with the staff
Nobody's
draft.
Okay with the staff draft. There's just a lot going on. What we're doing is I've proposed a single subject, which Mr. Blake is not entirely on board with. So we've gone to a very broad single subject of just marriage, and now I'm putting in my shorter version of the rest of it, having Steve replace the staff draft with that, and then we'll see if we can reach something like consensus. I didn't.
While he's typing, let me just ask, I mean, what is the most important provision in your proposal?
The statement that the government cannot define marriage, either implicitly or explicitly. So, implicitly, an example of that would be the government issuing a marriage license to a same-sex couple. They are implicitly defining marriage.
But just to further my, if, pure hypothetical.
Pardon?
Say I'm a pure hypothetical. If the Supreme Court were to say marriage is between a man and a woman, you would acknowledge then that this statutory language at that point is null, even under your provision.
Well, hypothetically, but I'm not expecting the Supreme Court to go back on that. And actually, when this was first submitted, it was all constitutional. The entire thing was a constitutional amendment. This was intentionally drafted, most of it is in statutory language so that it can be amended at a later date if need be.
I'm making it shorter, I promise.
I'm fine with it.
Thanks.
We're gonna adjourn at 5:30 today. So if there's anybody who's waiting on one of theirs that would rather just push it over until the morning, anyone? No? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I think, based on prior, I think it's a little redundant now to have the eliminating governmental involvement up there.
Yeah.
So that's, where did that, yeah, that clause you can just take out down to the semicolon. Okay.
Do you have any comment on what we have up there?
I think it looks fine. But I'm only at line 7. But otherwise, it looks fine.
So is line 7 or 6 going into 7 accurate that even if the courts reversed themselves and decided that marriage means something different, that the state would still be prohibited from enacting or recognizing a law that defines marriage?
Well, I mean, it's a hypothetical question.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, it's...
I mean, it seems to me that's what the statutes say, but I'm just asking because we've had this discussion about how all of this is sort of contingent on that first statement, which is the court's interpretation of the Establishment Clause and the due process.
Right. And
right.
You know, maybe in other states, litigation might ensue, which, you know, establishes...
Well, we don't.
I'm trying to.
Yeah, we don't really get into theory. I'm just saying, is that what it does? Does it, regardless of what happens in the first clause, does it prohibit a state or local government from enacting or recognizing any law that defines marriage?
I'm not quite certain I honestly understand the question.
Well, the question is
concerned civil.
Let's say that some court in the future decides that equal protection and, you know, establishment and due process, that you can still, as a state, if you want to, define marriage as just between a man and a woman. Wouldn't your initiative still prohibit the state from doing that because you have said that it cannot recognize... You can't get into this definition of marriage. Only a person or a couple
right.
can define what a marriage is.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think what I said earlier kind of answers that in the sense that this is statutory language. And so if there's any inconsistency between what a court says in the statutory language, the General Assembly can amend it so that everything is consistent. Versus what we have going on here with the Constitution, where it says that marriage is between one man and one woman. Well, I mean, that's kind of difficult to actually change. I'm just having to do a favor here and take care of it as I go along my merry way.
Okay. Well, you have anything else in the language, David? I mean, I think it's pretty good considering what we got.
I think it's awfully good articulating what the words on the paper of the initiative.
Okay. So let me read it, and then we can see if we're tripping over any words. So as it is now, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution and a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning marriage, and in connection therewith, replacing the statement in the Colorado Constitution that only a union of one man and one woman is valid or recognized as a marriage, with a statement requiring the state of Colorado to respect the establishment, equal protection, and due process clauses of the United States Constitution for issues concerning civil unions and marriages, and enacting new statutes that prohibit the state or a local government from enacting or recognizing any law that defines marriage, require recognition of all out-of-state marriages and previously established Colorado marriages as civil unions, authorize laws and rules governing civil unions, and require the amendment or repeal of all existing inconsistent laws or rules.
What's the...
Okay.
In line 7, before defines, and in the statute I use, implicitly or explicitly defines marriage. I mean, it's, and I heard you kind of shoot down the guy who used an adverb earlier, and perhaps you might have the same rule. I think
it's more so, I think that it's fewer words to just say defines. I think it encompasses both. And also, since laws are in written text, it's hard for them to be implicit necessarily. I mean, they state stuff. It's there in ink
mm-hmm.
or computer pixels or whatnot. I'd be prefer to keep that as is.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Okay, then you want to make a motion?
I do. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16 number 114 as now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2013-2014 number 104. If the proponents could come up to the...
I'm sorry, it's 127?
Oh, 120, sorry. I'm looking at the old one. See, this time I did my homework.
You
127.
Just take a moment, quick break.
Oh, no, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Mr. Runkle, would you mind coming up when you get the chance?
right, we're back on the record on proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 127. The proponents could come forward.
Yeah, I would just get rid of this.
Introduce yourself and your proponent.
Okay, yeah, I'm Earl Stalen, one of the proponents of initiative number 127.
Okay.
And my co-sponsor is David Runco.
Do you want to start by telling us the single subject of your initiative?
The single subject is to establish a state-owned bank.
And we've heard this initiative a few times in the past. Can you just let us know what you have changed since the last time you were here?
The primary change is to make it a Tabor enterprise. Under the Tabor Act, there's a specific exception for what they call enterprises, which are self-sustaining organizations or businesses that essentially don't require depending on taxpayer money for their income. Yeah. We've changed the districts slightly from 5 to 7 to make it administratively much easier to correspond with the 7 congressional districts rather than create 5 new districts that would involve a lot of additional administrative difficulties.
Do you have any questions?
Not at this point.
All right. You want to make a motion or discussion?
I don't know. Does anyone want to discuss single subject, or do we think this one has on the last for history for anyone who's curious or doesn't remember? Last time, this was 2013-14, number 104. It had a few other provisions, including one allowing the bank to be backed by the full faith and credit of the state, which is no longer in there. The bank wasn't an enterprise, which is sort of a specific exception at Tabor, and had some other Tabor implications that were more complex than it does now. I think with the changes, I'm inclined to find that we have a single subject for this measure.
In 104, then it must have been a 2-to-1 vote, because we did set a title. So it was probably...
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you must have been the one. So you're satisfied now.
I care. Did you both vote? I can't remember.
I think it was. So. I think it was when Dan Domenico was here.
I think I've actually voted both ways on this.
Oh, okay.
Multiple versions of it.
Okay. So right. Anyway, but you're satisfied.
I believe that
so.
They've scaled down the things that were most concerning to me in the past. However, I may have actually voted that as it stands before us today that it's a single subject.
Okay. Then why don't you make the motion?
All right. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-16 number 127 concerning establishment of a state-owned bank has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. And I've asked Steve, the staff draft is one of the longest I've ever seen. I've asked Steve to substitute mine as a starting point. I hope that's acceptable to all.
It's fine with me. Did you use 104 at all?
I did.
Okay.
I used what we had initially set and then ended up denying on 104.
Okay.
And I don't have changes marked, so I'm not quite sure how much. Well, I changed a little bit, like the 7-member board and making an enterprise. So there are changes here, but I don't think I've clearly marked how different they are from what we had before.
Do you have any comments on what we have up on the screen now?
I just need a minute to
read.
Okay. I like it, yeah.
Someone else up to comment, I think.
My name is Dan Bergman, speaking for myself only. The proponents mentioned that this proposed amendment to the state constitution is an independent state-owned bank, but it's how can it be independent if it's publicly owned by the state? So there seems to be a question of jurisdiction there. And it just doesn't seem to flow.
We don't use independent in the title, so do you have any comments on the title?
Not at this time, thank you.
Yeah.
Steve, only thing, I think semicolon's out of a comma at the end of line 6.
Do you have anything, David? Do you want to see 104? You're good. No. I'll go ahead and read it in.
I've been through this one enough time. I think.
Too bad it's not Groundhog Day. An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the establishment of a publicly owned state bank as an enterprise exempt from the requirements of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, and in connection therewith authorizing the bank to lend money for public purposes, requiring all assets of the state held by other financial institutions to be transferred to the bank, creating a 7-member board of directors elected from each state congressional district to manage the bank, and a 9-member advisory board appointed by the governor to advise the board of directors, allowing the bank to issue revenue bonds to capitalize itself and to support its facilities and operations, requiring independent annual audits of the bank's finances, and specifying that the amendment supersedes conflicting constitutional state and local laws.
I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2015-16 number 127 as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016 number 131. And if those proponents could come forward. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Have we done the submission clause?
The submission clause is automatically, the changes to the title are adopted in the submission. So when you see it come out, the changes will be reflected.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Why don't you, if you could start out by introducing yourself, your other proponent, and then tell us the single subject of your measure.
Sure. My name is Rob Smoke. I'm a proponent of 131, and this is Therese Howard, and she's the other proponent listed. And the single subject is the rights of individuals who are unhoused in Colorado.
Anyone have any questions? No.
No.
Discussion?
No. Did we ask if anyone else has anything to say?
Oh. Is there anyone here who wishes to speak on this issue? I don't have anyone signed up. But.
Okay. Then I'll start off. I mean, to me, it seems like all of the rights enumerated and protected by the proposed initiative seem to me to be necessarily and properly connected to the single subject of putting persons experiencing homelessness on equal footing with others with respect to certain sort of defined human needs. So, you know, I think there's a single subject here.
Yeah, and I have, I think it's, I mean, in 3D, we get into Fourth Amendment rights to search and seizure on in public spaces. We get into housing discrimination. Later on, I'm just not sure how these are all.
I'm happy to offer a comment. Or
go ahead.
Well, in terms of under 3, where the following basic rights are guaranteed and the connection of those one to the other, the context for this is, you know, a body of law that's all has to do with discrimination of people with based on their housing status. And perhaps it's hard to perceive from perspective sitting here today, but certainly in the perspective of people who are homeless, there's a very direct connection between the right to a reasonable expectation of privacy on one's personal property in public spaces and the others, because effectively, as a practice, the police in Denver and other cities along the Front Range and in Colorado will enforce specific laws in these areas together at the same time. So if you receive a camping ticket, you're exponentially more likely to have your property searched or removed. And this is based on hundreds of actual written surveys that have been taken and extensive testimony that was presented at the state capitol this year in a legislative committee hearing. So there's ample evidence to, and I think it's very clear in people's minds also, that that type of intervention by police is what's occurring on the streets, not these laws are that criminalize the homeless are being enforced one with another. You know, the aspect of taking personal property from people or searching it happens simultaneously with things like people being stopped from sharing food or people being stopped because they're attempting to sleep or rest in an outdoor location. So these 4 items under number 3, A, B, C, and D, are all directly from the Right to Rest Act, which was the act sponsored by, the legislation sponsored by Representatives Melton and Salazar before the committee this year, the Judiciary Committee this year. And that's why it was also in my title named the Homeless Survival Act, because we're not, we actually pared it down a little bit from Right to Rest. Right to Rest in the, I think in the draft version that you have, or one of them, it includes the right to move to, move freely in public spaces. And since there are all kinds of ordinances and statutes and so forth that exist that we would not challenge that have to do with those activities, it's not included in this constitutional amendment. The things that are included here have to do directly with people surviving under these circumstances, and they do address the specific behavior of our local governments and law enforcement in addressing homelessness through police action.
Okay. So your position is that really all this does is it's all related to law enforcement, essentially.
Well, it's
really
all related
just
to
doing 3, A, B, C, and D. And the rest is are definitions that relate back to those.
And it also, most civil rights legislation, it prohibits discrimination. It's, let's see, number 2B said basic rights shall be enumerated to include prohibition of discrimination based on housing status. And that would be the only suggestion I would have about the title, is that we include a very short phrase that includes that, because it's effectively it's a major portion, even though it's a short phrase in the actual wording of the amendment.
Which one? Where are you?
Well, if you look at 2 A and B, the state and any county, city, municipality, or other subdivision that has laws, ordinances, rules, or regulations that infringe on the basic rights enumerated in the proposed amendment shall cease enforcement of such laws.
But the basic rights enumerated are the ones in 3 A, B, C, and D, right?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Right. Yeah. So
the basic rights are.
So we don't need to add. Okay. All right.
Well, I guess in the minds of the proponents and the people who've worked on Right to Rest, which is, you know, 95% of what's here, a prohibition on discriminatory acts based on housing status is, you know, fundamental. So.
Well, I guess that was my question.
Yeah.
Is that meant to be something different than what's in 3 A, B, C, and D? I mean, is say that discrimination is a much broader, any kind of discrimination is much broader than saying these four enumerated things?
Okay.
Aren't they? I mean, can you discriminate if somebody wants to take a table at your restaurant? Can you discriminate if somebody wants to rent an apartment? Can you, I mean, what are you trying to accomplish statement?
Well, under 6A, we specifically define discrimination based on housing status means any distinction, exclusion, or restriction based solely on whether an individual has a fixed or regular residence. Discrimination based on housing status also includes any action that disproportionately impacts persons of a particular housing status. Measures taken to ensure equal enjoyment or to exercise in the human right to rest are not considered discriminatory.
Right, and that's where I have the issue, is in this very broad sort of undefined language. I don't necessarily have an issue with 3A through D, but then when you sweep in everything else that has nothing to do with law enforcement, it's this very broad category of other types of discrimination.
Well, distinction, exclusion, or restriction based solely on whether an individual has a fixed or regular residence would be something that, you know, theoretically would be decided only in the face of a complaint in a court of law, I would suspect. But in the meantime, these laws that have been, you know, functionally created to target homeless individuals, and a lot of them are just, you know, within the last 2, 3, 4, or 5 years, as is the case in Boulder, we can't see exactly what's coming around the next curve. So it may be broad language, but we feel very strongly that it belongs in this amendment.
Okay, but these are laws apart from 3 A, B, C, and D. You anticipate laws apart from what you define here.
Well, that phrase does anticipate them to a degree, but not, we're not specifically defining further laws that haven't been created. But I would ask the board to consider that many laws that are similar to the ones that we're contesting have existed and have been taken off the books, the so-called sundown laws or sunset laws, where people are told they can be in a city but have to leave after a certain, you know, at nightfall and so forth, Jim Crow laws, things of that nature. And you know, frankly, there's just no basis by which we can, you know, elucidate what those would be in the future. But we've seen in just recent history, you know, a whole string of laws related to the, specifically the four things that we mentioned under 3 A, B, C, and D. So it, I really do believe that it is necessary to have that in there.
I mean, I think it's fine that you have it in there. I just think you're creating two separate subjects when you do it, because you're taught, if you had just this discrimination part in there, or you just had 3 A, B, C, and D. But A, B, C, and D go beyond what's in discrimination, because the right to a reasonable expectation of privacy in your car is not necessarily discrimination based on housing status. So I don't see those really connected to each other, and that's where I have a problem with this being a single subject. But that being said, it sounds like you have one board member, and maybe we need to hear from David, because I'm not seeing it.
Well, I'll ask, is it the creation of homelessness as a protected class, or is it the decriminalization of homelessness?
I don't believe that this legislation or this amendment would create a protected class, no. Because I don't believe that the housing status or social status of poverty, being in poverty without housing, let's say, is, I'm not sure, it's not something that would be universally recognized as a protected, you know, there's no simple solution to that.
But isn't that what you're doing in 6A, making it a protected class?
Well, we're asking that these laws not be enforced so that people who otherwise are just committing acts of survival be allowed to continue to proceed to survive. If you're told that you cannot be in a public space, and you're also, of course, illegal on anyone's private space who isn't giving you permission to be there, then functionally the authority in that case or law enforcement is saying, you don't have a right to exist. And in practice, that is actually more or less what comes across when people are, we've had sweeps recently in Denver where—
I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, but if we passed a law, I mean, if you brought us a measure like this that said, you can't discriminate on gender, you'd be creating a protected class for gender, right?
Okay.
And then if you also said, and by the way, you know, any gender can have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your car.
Okay.
I mean, well, those are kind of two different things to me.
Well, so, a person's gender won't change if they become unhoused. A person's housing status is something that could change in a moment, or in a day, or in a week, and
right. And on the day that you are homeless, you're in a protected class.
Okay, but we're
the next day you're not.
Well, but in this act, we're trying to protect circumstances related to survival. So we're not talking about permission to.
But it goes beyond that, right? It goes beyond that to discrimination. I mean, the definition, I think what Ms. Dyer's trying to get at is your definition of 6A doesn't just go to that, right? It goes broader than that. And so does 6D.
Okay. 6D harassment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll just ask, does it go beyond Do 6A or 6D go beyond?
I'm not an attorney, and I can only tell you what I believe, and I believe this is about decriminalization. If we were to use other language to address that issue, we would not be addressing it. We are forced to deal with the realities of what is occurring on the streets in cities across Colorado and in conjunction with laws that are being put on the books as municipal ordinances or statutes. So in terms of relating to that and in terms of addressing the survival issues of people being impacted, we have to do it this way. And I'm certainly not a constitutional expert on what constitutes a protected class, but I am certainly convinced that this is primarily decriminalization. And it applies, of course, to all Coloradans who at any moment, theoretically, any person could become without housing or homeless. So,
yeah. And I think that's the, so you don't think you're creating a protected class, but you do think you're decriminalizing? I'm trying to drill down on what you believe the single subject.
Yeah, that's my belief, and
does 6A sweep in anything beyond criminal conduct? Now, just for the record, I'll read it. Discrimination based on housing status means any distinction, exclusion, or restriction based solely on whether or not an individual has a fixed or regular residence. So am I discriminating when I engage in any conduct that distinguishes, excludes, or restricts, which would be anybody, not just a criminal violation? I think that's the distinction that what we're trying to drill down on. Because if you're creating a protected class, I think Ms. Steyer is articulating that is a subject. And if you're decriminalizing, that is a different subject. Different actors, different protections, different scopes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your definitions of who is affected by it, I don't think changes because of your definitions of who is somebody, is homeless, is somebody without it. And I understand that changes that day to day, but I can be in a protected class when I'm, or not in a protected class when I'm 39, 351 days, but then I'm in a protected class when I'm 40, or I don't even know what it is, the date. But that's not, right? You can be in a protected class on Monday and not in a protected class on Tuesday. So I'm not sure that that's all that relevant. I think that's what we're trying to drill down on. So if you think the single subject is decriminalization, then I think this sweeps farther than that.
Well, Therese, do you have any comment?
Jason, you want to?
I think I understand what you're saying. And I'm not sure exactly how to address it. So, I do believe that the material cited here by the framers of the Right to Rest Act, which is incorporated into this, is the most essential material. The four items listed under number three. Yeah. So I think that is the most essential material. So if you're saying that our wording in 2A and B is unacceptable or somehow conflicts with 3A, B, C, and D, beyond that.
I don't think it conflicts, and I think commonly people bring in, their wish list of here's what I would like in an initiative in a perfect world.
Okay.
And we see that all the time. I'd like all these things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all of those things are interconnected or are a single subject, and I think that's what you did here. I think that if it had been 3A, B, C, and D, that'd be fine. Or if it had been 6A alone with the no discrimination portion, that would have been fine. But I think that when you put the two of them together, I think that some people would be surprised to know that discrimination was also going to include a right not to have your property searched in a public place. That's not necessarily discrimination. That's a separate kind of right.
Well, in that case, you know, I think we're asking that people who are homeless receive the benefit of the same right that is extended freely and amply to people who are housed. So it's not creating a, you know, it's not creating a new, something new, a new basis for a new right. It's just extending something that already exists.
Jason, you want to help me out here?
Well, I mean, I think there's probably a single subject essentially of, you know, concerning base, and I would say basic rather than human, just given the language of the initiative, basic rights of persons experiencing homelessness. You know, it lists, I'd note that, you know, 6A, it's just a definition, and the substance to which it applies is in 2B.
Right.
Such basic rights shall be enumerated to include prohibition of discrimination based on housing status. And, you know, while the drafting may or may not be perfectly artful, I think there's a little danger here of us getting a little too far down the rabbit hole and looking at potential effects and, you know, knowing a lot about the details of constitutional law here when what it looks like they're saying, and I think the point on, you know, 3D was very well put, is, you know, it's not a separate right of privacy. It's interlinked with this non-discrimination. It's as much right to privacy as someone else who's differently situated with respect to housing. And, you know, some of these other things, I think, in A, B, and C are sort of things that are disproportionately impact persons who, you know, are experiencing homelessness. So, like, if I'm parked sleeping in my car on a public street, I may well be stopped, but I can drive home. This happens much more commonly to someone who actually has to sleep in their car, as opposed to maybe, say, someone drives home and says, wow, you know, I had a really long day at work. I'm too tired to drive home. I think I'm going to pull over for a bit.
Right.
You know.
And just as a footnote, I would just say the car would still have to be legally, or the car or vehicle would still have to be legally parked.
Right.
For a person to be
in. In either case. But, I mean, I think the point is some of these things enumerated in three are things that might be enforced at some point or put against a person who's not necessarily experiencing homelessness, but they're much more commonly going to be enforced and impact much more severely someone who is.
Yeah.
And I think that 6A sort of implements, is intertwined with that and implements those provisions.
But they only apply to people who are homeless. So if I rest on a public space, not obstructing the use or access to private property, I can be arrested.
Sure. Right. Well, no, I don't think so on this because...
Well, because I'm not homeless. Anyone,
yeah, but you can... what they're saying is that anybody can do that because if I do it, you know, right now there's, you know, maybe I would be arrested or told to move along or whatever, you know, anti-loitering or whatnot, but it's... What I feel like they're trying to do with the discrimination is saying these are certain laws yeah. that in the way they work disproportionately, whether intentionally or not, and in some cases maybe intentionally, disproportionately impact people who don't have anywhere else to go, essentially.
Yeah. So now anybody's personal property in a public space is no longer subject to search.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the 3D explicitly specify that you have to be
I wouldn't
being homelessness to have these rights. It's to everybody.
And yeah, under four, we use the words every person under four. So,
okay.
I would want, so.
I mean, I do get the point. I mean, I think...
Not every homeless person,
you know,
it's every person.
If you get too far down, if you go far down into concerning impacts, you know, this, I think, 6A could sort of work the opposite way. And do you say that, you know, me having to pay property tax is discrimination based on housing status, because if I didn't own a home, I wouldn't have to, you know. But I don't, you know, it's... You know, there's a lot of ways to look at it, but I don't know that going too far in the effects. I mean, I think there's a... I guess what I'd say is I get what's attempted to be being done here, and I think that the language reasonably enough accomplishes that to not be a second subject.
But then doesn't that mean that the subject is really just concerning human rights of persons? If you're saying it doesn't matter whether you're homeless or not,
yeah,
then you can sleep in your car, you can do all these things. Well, and then, by the way, you also can't discriminate against people who are homeless.
Well, maybe so. Then maybe.
But there is a context and there's a reason why we're here today. And it's because these laws are unjustly focused in practice. I mean, I would love to not be here today. I would love to not have to advocate for this.
Right, but that's the... you said earlier that this was a decriminalization effort, not an effort to create a protected class.
Right.
So, but I totally miss the every person.
Well, on four...
This, by the way, which I'm trying to process as I speak.
Okay.
But... decriminalization would mean that this restricts government actors, and government actors only are the only ones that can enforce a criminal provision, right?
Mm-hmm.
This goes beyond that. This goes into business districts, private actors, private security guards, et cetera.
Okay.
And that's the difference between a protected class, in my mind at least, a protected class and decriminalization of crimes, regardless of who they affect. I mean, you've arrived at the conclusion that sleeping in your car affects homelessness or folks who are homeless more. Well, okay.
Provisions
that may
against,
or may not be, but it could be, but that crime can also be enforced against somebody who just pulled over on the side because they were tired while they were driving to their home, right? They're still violating the code that says you cannot sleep in your car.
And they'd receive protection under this amendment.
Well, I know. Yeah. That's a whole separate question I hadn't even picked up on.
Okay.
You touched on it, which is potentially even more problematic than the one that I was honing in on. But this would be bootstrapping a protected class to a decriminalization effort is how I see it.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not sure I agree with that perception. But
well, if you, like I said, if it's a decriminalization effort, then the scope of its impact should restrict government actors. They're the only ones that can affect and enforce criminal codes.
Well, not really. Okay. I would disagree with that, because district agents are empowered to do that in shopping malls.
And are they private entities?
Another location, yes. And they work for private entities. So, and we even have... We have private security personnel working for RTD and other agencies. So it can't, it doesn't. No, I'm sorry.
You're getting exactly to my point.
Okay.
Which is those people are enforcing restrictions that they have put in place to control their private property within the confines of what is allowed by law. And in making a protected class, that's when you trip into everybody's affected. And what you said this was a decriminalization effort. Therefore, I think the scope of the impacted group is the government. And I think it goes beyond that in several different places.
Okay.
And that's where you get into single subject problems.
I'm sorry.
For the example of a requirement that seeks to prevent surprise or fraud upon the voters. I think people would be surprised if they read a decriminalization provision that is decriminalizing conduct that homeless engage in more often than others, yet in fact it restricts private personnel and creates presumably a civil right. I'm not sure exactly how you would enforce 6A, but I presume it's some sort of a civil action because you now have a right to be protected from any of those types of discrimination, which sweeps much, much broader than decriminalizing things that negatively or disproportionately impact homeless. If I'm, I don't know if I'm articulating Dyer's point or not. And the every person part is equally, I think, surprising. I don't want to call it fraud. It's not fraud. But it would be surprising that all of a sudden I enjoy the same right as somebody who was homeless walking down the street just because I happen to be in a public space.
Yeah, and I think those are the concerns I had. And it sounds like Jason's not.
May I invite a comment from Therese Howard?
Sorry, this is Therese. I just wanted to clarify. We're talking about laws here. We're talking about laws put on the books by state and municipal governments. We're not talking about rules and ordinances, but by private entities. Private entities create all sorts of rules and ordinances for their own private entity that they have the freedom to do. So no, this is not changing, putting limitations or prohibitions on the rules and procedures of private entities. It is putting limitations on the rules and laws of the local and state governments. And the enforcers of those laws just so happen to often be private entities. The private security personnel do bleed over into enforcing laws which are public laws on the books. So that there's a bleed over there, but we're not targeting the private entities. It's the local laws of the municipality or city or state government that are the focus there. And one more comment in regards to the connection between discrimination and criminalization. Those two things are tied together because the act of criminalizing homelessness is something which happens as a result of the discrimination against people based on housing status. So it's because when I am homeless, I do not have my own private home. I therefore have to perform certain acts of survival in public spaces. Those acts of survival have laws placed on them which make them criminal. The discrimination comes in here because the laws are discriminating against me because I am homeless and making it and so that because of my housing status, I do not have the ability to do the same thing as someone who is housed, such as sleep and such as exist in these public spaces. While it is encompassing of all people, both the fact that it is encompassing all people and the fact that it is targeting the fact of discrimination is all a piece of the general right of everyone to survive in public space.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that creates a protected, I think what you just articulated is a protected class.
Do we have case law that says creating a protected class, I mean, it's an effect that it's inherently a second subject?
Well, no, but I think it would be I don't know the answer, to be clear. But I do think that the creation of a protected class, and I'm still stuck on four, because doesn't four then just mean the protected class is everybody? Because what you're going to say is everybody is only enjoys 3A, B, C, and D, but doesn't enjoy 6A, which means that they're different. You have a protected class, and then you have a decriminalization effort. And I think the goal, I think what you just said is probably right. You're trying to create what you're endeavoring to do is create homelessness as a protected class, and that would be fine. I mean, that's a fine initiative that you could write. But I think this is a decriminalization effort that results in the creation of homelessness as a protected class. And I think it violates first subject because that would be surprising. I mean, the case that I was citing was a first, was a single subject case.
Well, do you want to make a motion?
Jason's looking at me like no. He was going to say something.
Nope. Oh, sorry. I'm just turned.
Yeah, I will. I will make a motion that Initiative 2015-2016, number 131, contains more than one subject, and therefore we do not have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. So the board finds there is no jurisdiction, which takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 146. All right, Mr. Gruskin.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Gruskin. I am counsel to William Ray and to Richard Evans, the proponents of initiatives 146 through 155. Mr. Ray and Mr. Evans are in the audience here today in the back row. They have signed their affidavits and filed them with staff.
Do you want to tell us what the single subject of your measure is?
The single subject of Initiative 146 is the imposition of a transportation safety sales and use tax.
Was there any, I don't have anyone signed up. Does anyone want to speak on the single subject of this measure? Okay. All right. Where did we end up on fiscal impact? Well, why don't we do single subject?
Yeah, and then I think we should call up and talk about that.
Okay. Do you have anything on single subject?
I don't have anything on single subject. I just, it's five. We're going forward even though there's nine of these.
Well, see, here's my thought. We set the first one, and then I leave.
it's really a question for the proponent. We're digging into this one and then coming back tomorrow to do the remainder. I'm just clarifying.
I don't know. Well, I mean, seriously, if you guys want to stay, I don't want to dictate everyone's schedule, but 5:30 is my hard stop.
Right.
I'm happy to plow forward. Them all.
Right. The proponent's happy to plow forward. We'll plow forward.
For the record, let's make a little bit of progress today and then
okay.
Pick up the ball tomorrow and shave that much more time off tomorrow's agenda.
Okay. Mr. Bergman, did you have a comment on single subject?
I did. I believe that we're looking at two different subjects. We're looking at a change to Colorado revised statutes and a fiscal impact, and the two are separate.
Well, this is required language, so I'm not sure that would. We have to state the fiscal impact.
No, we get into amounts for budgets, and that's separate from the proposal to increase taxes.
All right. Do you have anything on single subject, Jason?
Let's see. I think that we have one.
Okay. You want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find the proposed initiative 2015-16 number 146 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
So, do you want to make any comments on the title language, Mr. Gruskin? Or
I would. I'd like to suggest some language.
Okay.
Given the fact that we're only going to take up one today.
We might get to more.
All right. Well, then.
Underestimate.
Wait till you see my proposed title, 5-minute approach.
Is it going to be really short?
No.
No.
But it's really simple. It simply reorders language and provides clarity. And that's a packet of all 10. That's why I started to disassemble them. So let me, if I could, walk the board through this document. The $689 million comes from the fiscal impact statement. Let me take a step back, if I could. A little bit of background. We went to review and comment, and staff pointed out that after conferring with various folks at Legislative Legal Services, the belief was that there is a constitutional designation of all excise taxes to the old age pension fund, and that without additional language to make clear that there was a reservation of at least some amount of money, that all the money would go be designated for the old age pension fund, potentially to be appropriated by the General Assembly. So that was why some of this language that refers to the $739 million was placed in this measure. But we believe that it is, by juxtaposing the two figures, the 689 and the 739, it is confusing. And so we've tried to clarify the language in a couple of different ways. One is by placing the language in an order that would make optimal sense, we think, to voters. The other, and this is important, the measure itself, the ballot title talks about an additional 62/100% state tax. And honestly, that's not how we wrote it. The measure 146 and through 154 are all written as a function of an imposition of a tax of 6.2 cents for each $10. Either on the sales or the use tax. And we did that because the statute, as the board knows, requires that, or excuse me, 1-40-1051 says proponents are encouraged to write such drafts in plain, non-technical language and in a clear and coherent manner using words with common and everyday meaning which are understandable to the average reader. And honestly, I'm not sure that the notion of an additional 62/100% tax would be immediately translated by, forget average voter, average lawyer, into a known tax amount. So that's why we wrote it this way. We think the title should reflect that, because it's the plain language of the actual language of the measure. So we believe, and I know we're going to have a conversation about whether or not we have to include a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes in a TABOR title, and I encourage that. But we believe that the tax ought to be reflected as it is written in the measure, and so that it will be understood by voters. We think that the language in connection with the reservation of funds from the old age pension fund under the Constitution doesn't need to be the very next provision, but what does need to be the next language is that language which talks about how the money is allocated, both in terms of going to states, counties, and municipalities, which is largely the language that exists in the current title, requiring that state revenue go to transportation safety and congestion relief projects, in each of the state's transportation districts every 3 years, then simplifying the disclosure provisions and then putting the fact that this is money reserved when allocated to the HUTF. Okay. So we can talk about the specific language, but hopefully this is a discussion document that we can use for purposes of setting the title. And let me just add that I am assuming that based upon the Ledge Council revenue impact statement, that it's
various findings of current expectations and an estimate based on historical forecast errors, that the board would typically use the former rather than the latter. And that seemed to be what Ledge Council said in the last paragraph. And that's why we've used the $689.1 million.
And I think I'd like to, at this time, if we could have Greg Sobetsky come up and explain to us the fiscal impact statement, and we should have a discussion on that issue.
Madam Chair, members of the board, my name is Greg Sobetsky. I'm an economist with the Legislative Council staff, and I'll be speaking to the memorandum provided to the title board from Larson Silbaugh of our office, dated April 14th.
Okay.
So the memorandum that was provided to the title board includes four estimates, two of which pertain to initiative 2015-2016 number 146. The two estimates include a point estimate of a total increase in state revenue of $689.1 million and a maximum revenue estimate with a total increase of state revenue of $759.4 million. The difference between those two estimates is that the former estimate is based on Legislative Council staff's current expectations for the state sales and use tax bases for fiscal year 2017-2018. The latter estimate inflates the former estimate by a forecast error, which is attained from determining the maximum downside error in prior forecasts of these revenue streams with this forecast horizon. And that's provided to the members of the title board for their consideration with respect to subsection 3, paragraph B, subparagraph 3 of the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights.
Questions?
I don't. I have comments and can clarify if either of you have questions. I think that so what I think is the reason for the second estimate essentially is what we found in the past is we had to go to the ballot again, you know, with respect to Amendment 64, and we had to do, I believe it was BB, Proposition BB, to let us actually keep the money that the voters had already intended to say that we could keep, because the estimate had come in, the number put in the blank had come in lower than the money that had come in. That's a slightly simplified version of it, but regardless, and I think relying this higher estimate is designed to sort of avoid that type of thing from happening again. I think it's within our authority to use the higher estimate. There's nothing that says explicitly we have to do. I mean, we do know, as I like to tell our economists all the time, that their projections are by definition are always wrong, and as they freely admit. So, you know, even though it's based on, you know, that the lower number is sort of the best guess and this is more of a safer guess, both are still guesses. You know, I think Tabor itself, sort of the intent of including the number is to have sort of the highest number you think you might bring in. And I think that's what this does. So I would encourage the board to actually adopt the higher number.
Okay.
That's all.
Mr. Gruskin, did you want to respond to that at all?
I think that the planning for the possibility rather than the inevitability of finding that the higher number is the one that is used. I mean, there is a system fix, and it's exactly what happened with Ref B, which is you put that to the voters. But if you know that the current number based upon reasonable prognostications is the 689 million. And that's what we are tied to, subject to the reservation from the old age pension fund of 739 in this one. Then that's the appropriate number to use. I don't know that you use a budget forecast based upon likely errors or possible errors. And therefore, I would suggest that the 689 million is the more appropriate number for us to use. It was also, frankly, the basis for our use of the specific reservation out of the old age pension fund, because the whole conversation at review and comment was about kind of that more basic number, which led, you know, to the staff, to their credit, staff had not run yet. So it was based upon what we had anticipated rather than what we had anticipated based upon historic collections with an error factor, as the higher number would indicate. And I guess the point is, it's it ought to be the proponent's decision as to how far this measure goes, and if we've had to circumscribe it by $739 million, for instance, then we ought not have a tax increase that we cannot spend under the balance of the provisions be the determining number at the beginning of the ballot title. We're willing to live with a lower number subject to the revenue cap. I think that the proponents ought to be given that that opportunity. And if there is a refund that has to happen, then there will be a refund that has to happen. Understanding that it's economics and nobody really knows what's going to happen, but I think the better approach is to use 689 million.
Mr. Grusin, just a question. Do you think that the language at the beginning of Tabor that says its preferred interpretation shall reasonably restrain most the growth of government has any relevance?
Well, the way the courts apply that, as you know, is where two interpretations of Tabor have a similar foundation, similarly weighty foundation, in the text of the Constitution, that you go with the one that will most restrain government. So I guess the question would be, what is it that is being interpreted in the text of Tabor? And my guess is that the most appropriate, that's the language in subsection 3, I believe, that has the shall district taxes be increased.
But you would, well, how do I ask this question?
You can make it a leading question if you want.
Of course, no. The obvious follow-up question is, wouldn't it be more likely that government growth is restricted, that is, your amendment fails, if the number is higher?
Honestly, given the state of the roads today, I'm not sure that the answer is true. But what is true is there will be less money to spend, and therefore the growth of government will be more restrained by using $689 million rather than 700 and whatever million. I don't have that piece of paper in front of me.
I mean, I think we're permitted to accept either. So I think it's really just the board's preference.
I don't know if we're permitted to split the difference. We're permitted to make up a number, but
yeah. I think this one has a basis. It's not arbitrary. The state economist has come up with it. And so I'm inclined to go with Mr. Gallander and accept the higher number. I don't think there's any error in doing that.
Madam Chair, I would only note that the revenue estimate memorandum concludes, and I quote, based on current expectations for the sales and use tax in FY 2017-18, tax revenue from the new taxes in initiatives 146 to 154 will be $689.1 million in the first full fiscal year for which the new taxes are effective. The conclusion of staff was that 689 was the reliable number.
Could you, Mr. Grusin, just explain to me, because I was struggling with the 739 number that you guys use. How is that based on slash related to the 689 or whatever it is? Where does that number come from?
a good question, Mr. Gellner. The answer was that there was a rough estimate at the time of review and comment of about, and I forget what I said at review and comment, I don't want to, but it was about $700 million. And so there was a sense that maybe there ought to be a little bit more afforded just in case the revenue estimate came in higher than we thought.
Okay.
So the answer is 739 was what was reasonably anticipated based upon the economists who did an assessment for us who are not working for Ledge Council, and then adding, I don't know, $35 million or $39 million to that just in case Ledge Council's number came in higher. The base number came in higher.
So the intention is to just make sure that all the revenue goes for the purposes in the initiative.
That's exactly it. And I think here's the, without putting too much on the record, it seems to me the because I know you have just a few minutes left, the notion that this number ensures that the money will be used for the transportation safety purposes for which the tax is engendered is consistent with the single subject that we have ascribed to this measure, rather than having leftover money that somehow gets appropriated because under Tabor it can be used by the state for other purposes.
Yeah, and this brings me back, and I think that's a very worthy concern. I was thinking about a while back, we talked to folks about that voter tax, and where the problem was the way they did the math, a whole bunch of that money was going to go to the general fund. And we thought that that was problematic or at least needed to be referenced so as to not be surreptitious. And I believe that if we did set the higher number here, then and say it came in at 775, actual came in at 775 million, that overage over the 739 would end up flowing to old age pension fund and then eventually end up in the general fund. I believe, and I'm seeing nods from both our economists and Mr. Gruskins and other people in the audience, so I feel that that sounds right, and maybe that's something that does need to be avoided and, you know, weighs against my prior argument on taking the higher number. Now, we can, of course, I think, do what they intended to and take the 739 number and match what's in the text of the initiatives, and then we sort of have the benefit of all the money's going to go where it's supposed to go. And we have a little bit of cushion over the best guess forecast and sort of split the baby, so to speak.
And we would be fine with that approach. The other, it's consistent with the single subject, it's accurate to the text, and it's consistent with at least the reasonable best guess of staff. It also will shorten your title because you won't have to readdress the $739 million reservation.
Yeah, I'm fine with that general concept in the formula. You?
I think Mr. Cruz can convince me it should be the 689 number. I liked his answer.
Okay.
I think that was right. I was thinking of it the other way, but I think he's more right. So.
Everyone's right, but he's more right.
Well, yeah, you can use any of the numbers, right? Justifiably, I think we agree we can use any of the numbers. Right. The only thing I think we probably also, the only thing we definitely agree on is we can't use a range. So.
Yeah. Okay. So, Jason, what do you want to do?
Well, first, I think I'll ask Mr. Gruskin, is your preference to be the most right or to have $739 million?
Is that the board's determination that 689 is most right, or is that?
Well, it's Mr. Blake's determination. I think 689 is most right.
Can I confer with the proponents to find out since it's...
And then while they're conferring, whatever determination we make on that, can we agree that we'll consistently
yes.
apply it, and that way we don't have to bring the economist back?
Yes.
That's very nice of you to say. I can't imagine it's true. Okay.
I think notwithstanding the fact that we would like to be right, we would like to be most right. And so I think the most defensible number from a possible ballot title challenge is going to be 689. And so I think we'll go with 689 if that's the board's pleasure.
I'm fine with it.
Okay. Then we'll go with 689, and we'll apply that same logic as we go through all 10 of these tomorrow morning.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to get through the questions, so.
Are we going to cut off now?
Yeah, so why don't we adjourn on that point and then take it back up at, what are we, 8:30, Steve? Is that going to work for you?
Absolutely will.
Okay.
But you have ruled on the single subject, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I think we already.
We'll see
you. We already did that, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
8:30, thank you.
All right, time's 5:20, and we are adjourned till tomorrow morning at 8:30.